right, we pick up this week in 2 Chronicles chapter 21, and I know we haven't been in the books of Chronicles much for quite a long time. For those of you who have been with us since we started this study in the Divided Kingdom, you remember that in the early part of it, we were alternating back and forth between the books of Kings and the books of Chronicles. And for the past, well, it's actually been about a year now, we haven't looked at Chronicles much. We have a little bit. The reason is that since that time, we've been following through the stories of Elijah and Elisha and how they dealt with King Ahab and the later kings in the Northern Kingdom. And here we need to remind you of a point that we haven't talked about for quite a while. It's this, that after the kingdom divides, the kingdom of Israel, after Solomon, after his death, his son Rehoboam makes some foolish choices and loses control of the northern 10 tribes. And from that time on, there's a northern kingdom called Israel and a southern kingdom called Judah. And for the most part, well, the books of Kings and books of Chronicles contain parallel accounts of that time period. They tell a lot of the same stories. But for the most part, Kings gives more detail about the events that happened in the northern kingdom of Israel, and Chronicles will give more details about things that happened in the southern kingdom of Judah. Now, that's not true 100% of the time, but as a general rule, that's true. And since for quite a long time now, we've been dealing with the life and the ministry and the works of Elijah and Elisha, and their ministry was primarily to the northern kingdom. As a matter of fact, almost exclusively to the northern kingdom. We haven't looked at the book of Chronicles much during that time period. There have been some instances where the southern king, especially Jehoshaphat, who was the good king of the southern kingdom, he's come into the story here and there in his connection with Ahab and some of the alliances they made. But other than that, we haven't looked at the southern kingdom much. Now, in this lesson today, we come back to Chronicles because as the age of Elijah and Elisha is drawing to a close, we're going to fall back more into the vein that we were when we started this study and looking at the northern and the southern kingdoms alongside each other. And as we say, at this time, Elijah is already off the scene. Elisha has a little bit more work to do, but he's actually coming to the end of his ministry to finish that which was kind of the point of it to start with. And so we're going to see, we talked about this last time, we see that at this point God is bringing all the pieces together to execute his judgment on the wicked house of Ahab, who had been king of the north. And we have said before the reason that he deserves this special judgment, or that he's gone by now, he's dead, and God has already judged him. But the reason why his house is to be wiped out seems to be particularly because Ahab brought back into the kingdom of Israel the worship of Baal. Now, they had other idol gods besides Baal before Baal worship comes back in, but Baal is the most prominent of the Canaanite deities, and the worship of that false god was supposed to have been wiped out when they first came into the Promised Land. They failed in that charge, but the worship of Baal had disappeared from Israel, well, over 150 years before the time of Ahab. Samuel had called the people out to Mizpah, and he demanded that they give up the worship of Baal, and they were obedient. And after that, we find no more reference to Baal worship in the scripture until the time of Ahab. Now, as we say, the Lord is drawing events to their conclusion to destroy this house of Ahab, and he's got to get a lot of pieces of the puzzle in the right place at the right time to make this happen. I mentioned a week or two ago that some of God's miracles are not necessarily just the manipulation of physical circumstances, you know, as we think of multiplying fish and bread or making wine out of water or healings or things like that. Sometimes they're just miracles of timing. And God is the master of logistics. He has the ability to bring the right people into the right places at the right time. It's been a long time since Ahab has entered on his idolatrous path of Baal worship. By the time his house is wiped out, it's about 36 years after the beginning of his reign. And there's a lesson in there for us to be patient with God, because God works in his time and not ours. The northern kingdom has had to endure this wicked rule for 36 years before it's wiped out. Actually, longer than that if you count Ahab's father, Omri. But things are now coming to a conclusion. And we mentioned this last time about how one of the first pieces of the puzzle comes into play. Remember that when Elijah was commissioned to call Elisha to follow after him as the next prophet, he was told to anoint three people. And those three people were Hazael to be king of Syria, Jehu to be king of Israel, that is the northern kingdom, and Elisha to be the prophet in his room. This is all in 1 Kings chapter 19. And he said in the 17th verse of that chapter, "And it shall come to pass that him that escapeth the sword of Hazael shall Jehu slay, and him that escapeth from the sword of Jehu shall Elisha slay." And he's talking about the house of Ahab. Now we're going to see how this plays out. But we've got to get these right people in the right places. We've got to get Hazael on the throne in Syria. And we saw that last week. We talked about how the king of Syria was Ben-Hadad, who, by the way, should have been killed over a decade before by Ahab, but Ahab let him go, and that's one of the reasons why God killed Ahab. But this king is Ben-Hadad, and Hazael is one of his ministers, or one of his court officials. And when Ben-Hadad gets sick, he sends Hazael to go ask the prophet Elisha if he'll recover from his sickness. And the answer is very interesting. He says, "Thou mayest recover, but thou shalt surely die." In other words, it would be possible for you to recover from the sickness, but you're going to die by other means. And the reason Elisha said that is because he knew that Hazael, who was Ben-Hadad's trusted minister, actually was a traitor and had murder in his heart. He knew that he was going to go kill Ben-Hadad, and that's exactly what happened. He killed Ben-Hadad before he had a chance to recover, and he becomes king. Now, that's one piece in place. We've got Hazael on the throne in Syria. Now, the next thing we've got to deal with is to get Jehu on the throne in Israel. But in order to do that, we've got to get the right kings on the throne in Israel and in Judah for the time of this gathering storm of Jehu's wrath to come about. And this is where we left off last time. We were just looking at how this man named Jehoram, Jehoshaphat's son, had come to be king of the south. And let me remind you again, this is one of those places where the story gets very, very confusing. Because we have in the north King Ahab, and in the south King Jehoshaphat. They are roughly contemporary with each other. They rule around the same time and even make alliances and whatnot. And Ahab, when he dies, he leaves behind a son named Ahaziah to be king. He reigns briefly and dies without any sons. So instead of having a son for his heir, the kingdom is left to his brother, another son of Ahab, that is, his brother Jehoram. So in the north, we have King Ahaziah, followed by King Jehoram. In the south, just to make things thoroughly confusing, we have King Jehoshaphat, who dies, and he leaves behind a son named Jehoram, who reigns for about 8 years. And when he dies, he leaves the kingdom to his son, Ahaziah. So if you've got your scorecards and you're keeping up, in the north, we have King Ahaziah followed by King Jehoram. In the south, King Jehoram followed by King Ahaziah. And it's four different men. And as a matter of fact, at one point, there's a King Jehoram in the north and a King Jehoram in the south. They're two different people. So do try to keep up with all that. But the reason why this happened, and this is actually a very important part of the story, the reason why you end up with kings in the north and the south having the same name, most likely is because they develop family ties. And the worst thing that Jehoshaphat ever did, he was a good king for the most part. He was a very godly man. But he made a very critical mistake in that he took the daughter of Ahab to marry his son, Jehoram. And so he brings the influence of the house of Ahab into his own house. And that's a very grave mistake. This is a place where Christians ought to take heed, take warning, because the devil will exploit any crack he can find, any fissure. He'll stick his pry bar in it and spread it apart and make a great big mess. And this is what's going to happen in the southern kingdom. As a matter of fact, the influence of Ahab and Jezebel and their wicked house that brought Baal worship into the northern kingdom of Israel will live on in the south for a good while after it's wiped out in the north in its home. And it'll happen because of this intermarriage. Jehoshaphat married his son Jehoram to a woman named Athaliah. She's a son of Ahab, a daughter of Ahab. Some places she's called also a daughter of Omri. Omri was Ahab's father, and here's where we remind you that there aren't words for granddaughter or grandson. The word daughter would just mean a female descendant, so it would have been Omri's granddaughter, Ahab's daughter. And she's married to Jehoram. And because of this, it introduces this great wickedness into the southern kingdom that had already been there in the north. The south had had 66 years of good kings. Asa reigned 41 years. Jehoshaphat reigned 25. So for 66 years, they've had godly kings in the southern kingdom. And because of the influence of this daughter of Ahab, the southern kingdom now falls into the same kind of idolatry that was going on in the north. And we find that here in 2 Chronicles 21. This is the passage that we were picking up in here this morning. It says there in verse 1, "Now Jehoshaphat slept with his fathers and was buried with his fathers in the city of David, and Jehoram his son reigned in his stead. And he had brethren, the sons of Jehoshaphat, Azariah and Jehiel and Zechariah and Azariah and Michael and Shephatiah. All these were the sons of Jehoshaphat, king of Israel. And their father gave them great gifts of silver and of gold and of precious things with fenced cities in Judah, but the kingdom gave he to Jehoram because he was the firstborn." Now, I want you to notice the end of that third verse. It says he gave the kingdom to Jehoram because he was the firstborn. And that's interesting. I'm not going to make a great deal of this yet, but I want to plant a thought in your mind that we'll pick up a little bit later. And actually will become important even in the next lesson, next time, Lord willing. But this seems to imply that the transition of the monarchy from Jehoshaphat to Jehoram wasn't necessarily a given. It wasn't automatic just because Jehoram was the firstborn, but customary. It says the kingdom gave he to Jehoram because he was the firstborn. It's hard to imagine that it would have made that statement unless it were possible that he could have given it to one of his other sons, but he gives it to Jehoram because that's the custom. And verse 4 says, "Now when Jehoram was risen up to the kingdom of his father, he strengthened himself and slew all his brethren with the sword and divers also of the princes of Israel." He is one of those men who is so concerned about his power that he feels he has to wipe out any threat to his rule, even his own kindred. It's a very dangerous thing to be the brother of a king, especially a king who has no children, because they might be concerned about their throne. And they're always worried about losing their power. The old saying is, "Uneasy lies the head that wears the crown." And so he becomes a murderer. He kills all his brothers in order to consolidate his power. Verse 5 says, "Jehoram was 32 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 8 years in Jerusalem. And he walked in the way of the kings of Israel, like as did the house of Ahab, for he had the daughter of Ahab to wife, and he wrought that which was evil in the eyes of the Lord." The scriptures warn us in the New Testament, in the church, to come out from among them and be ye separate. They warn us not to be unequally yoked together with unbelievers. And that's very often applied to marriage, and it should be applied to marriage, but I think it extends far beyond that. it's a dangerous thing for Christians to start to ally themselves with the world. Jehoshaphat had made this marriage, evidently, between Jehoram and Athaliah. Who knows why? Maybe he thought he could bring about peace in the kingdom. Maybe he thought he could reunite the kingdom. Maybe he thought that he could, by bringing this woman into his house, turn her toward the good. But as is so often the case, it works the other way around. There's a warning lesson in here. Not to associate, not to involve yourself, at least intimately, with those who are unbelievers who don't serve the Lord. We see cases of this even down to this day. Sometimes you'll find that a person who's saved will marry someone who's not saved or go into business with somebody like that. Sometimes God blesses. Thank God for His grace. Sometimes He can use that situation to draw the lost partner to Christ. But very often it works the other way around. It becomes the influence that leads the one who was saved to walk out of fellowship with God. And if they do try to walk in fellowship with God, it'll be a very difficult road to follow, and there'll be a lot of misery. And it can lead to problems far down the line. We haven't heard the last of this Queen Athaliah. She's going to come back into the story here in a little while and caused the greatest crisis that ever occurred, really, in the southern kingdom, all the way up until Nebuchadnezzar showed up to take the kingdom into captivity. Well, it says in verse 7, "Howbeit the Lord would not destroy the house of David because of the covenant that he had made with David, and as he had promised to give a light to him and to his sons forever." That's an important verse. We've mentioned this before a long time ago, and we'll come back to it here, that in the northern kingdom, we had a whole series of different dynasties. There were different families that ruled the northern kingdom, different houses. And on the chart of the kings that I passed out back then, we had these different, we listed the house that each king belonged to in the north. And so we've had a succession of different houses because in the north, there is no unconditional covenant with the kings up there that God has promised to keep their house. So when they disobey, he can just destroy their whole house and put another family on the throne. That's what's about to happen with Ahab, who is of the house of Omri. We call it sometimes the house of Omri, sometimes the house of Ahab. But his house is going to be wiped out. Now, if Jehoram brings in the same idolatry, the same Baal worship into the south, into Judah, that Ahab brought into Israel in the north, you might think that God would wipe out his house. But there's one reason why he doesn't. The south is not like the north. We don't have all these different dynasties all the way through. Everybody through the divided kingdom age, everybody who rules in Judah is the seed of David. Well, except for one. And we've mentioned her name already today, Athaliah, who will become queen for a little while before she's put down. But other than that, it's always sons of David on the throne in the south. And the reason why was because in 2 Samuel chapter 7, God had made a covenant with David. He promised him a throne and a house and a kingdom forever. And God would not wipe out his line. Even though Jehoram deserved it, God, for the sake of his covenant to David, wouldn't end that. But he is going to have difficult days. Verse 8 said, "In his days the Edomites were revolted from under the dominion of Judah and made themselves a king. Then Jehoram went forth with his princes and all his chariots with him. And he rose up by night and smote the Edomites which compassed him in and the captains of the chariots. So the Edomites revolted from under the hand of Judah unto this day." The Edomites were descendants of Esau, and they had long had conflict with Israel, but for a long time, the kings of Judah had been able to keep them under tribute. And this man Jehoram loses that. It's a very interesting pattern you find that as the nation becomes disobedient to God, the nation becomes weak. They start to lose their influence. It starts to decay. So he loses his power over the Edomites. Next, it says, "The same time also did Libnah revolt from under his hand because he had forsaken the God of his fathers." The nation starts to decay and become weak when it disobeys God. I think we're seeing that in our own country today. As the nation turns away from, not just from God, but even from simple basic morality. The nation loses its influence in the world around it and begins to decay. It goes on, says, moreover, he made high places in the mountains of Judah and caused the inhabitants of Jerusalem to commit fornication and compelled Judah thereto. The high places up on the hills, that's where they would often worship idol gods. They seemed to think that if they could get to a higher elevation, they'd be nearer heaven. And so they'd worship gods up on these high places. We've seen that before. It says he caused the inhabitants of Jerusalem to commit fornication. And here I take it from the context that he means spiritual fornication. Remember that God was in a covenant relationship with Israel that is made at Mount Sinai. Israel promised to be in obedience to God up there on that mountain, or down there in the valley below that mountain, as God comes down to give them the law. And this relationship is likened to the relationship of a husband and wife in the book of Hosea. That's the picture that's given there, is that Israel is an unfaithful wife to her husband Jehovah because she's followed after false gods. And God is a jealous God. He won't put up with this. In Exodus chapter 20, that's, of course, the Ten Commandments. This is where this covenant is made. One of the things he says there in the fifth verse, is thou shalt not bow down thyself to them nor serve them. For I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generation of them that hate me. In the 34th chapter of Exodus, in the 14th verse, he says, for thou shalt worship no other God, for the Lord, whose name is jealous, is a jealous God. It says even his name is jealous. And you might say, well, that's a little petty, isn't it, for God to be jealous? Well, he's not jealous in the way that we are sometimes. And as a matter of fact, there is such a thing as a justifiable, even holy, jealousy. Now, we have given jealousy a bad rap because in our minds it's often become associated with desiring something that somebody else has, even though God hasn't given it to us or we're not entitled to it. And certainly that is an ungodly kind of jealousy. It makes up a lot of the jealousy that we have, if we're being honest. But there is a jealousy that's right. And I think we can see this even on the human level. If you're married, you have a spouse, and you stood up before God in some congregation somewhere and took vows to be faithful to one another, and you find out that your spouse is unfaithful, well, you've got a real right to jealousy. Now, sometimes this is misunderstood or abused. Sometimes I think we use the wrong word. We talk about people who are so jealous that it causes problems in their marriage. But the truth is, that's not really jealousy. That's suspicion. And the unwarranted suspicion, I guess we might say. Some people have an inability to trust, even if their partner's being honest. But if the partner is unfaithful, certainly you've got a right to jealousy. You took the vows, and you have a right to expect that the other party keep their vows. Now, in the case of Israel and God, Israel took the vows there at the foot of Mount Sinai when God made his covenant with him. And God won't accept that. There's going to be a judgment of this. And he's going to deal with the judgment upon Jehoram in the next passage. And starting in verse 12, we have a very, very interesting passage of scripture. And before we get into the prophecy, we want to read the first part here. It says, and there came a writing to him from Elijah the prophet. Now, that's interesting. And some people have claimed that there's a contradiction in the Bible here, because if you've been following along with us, you know that Elijah has been off the scene now for a good while. Remember, he's one of the two men who didn't die. God took him up in a chariot of fire. They took him up in a whirlwind. And so he's no longer present. And some have said, well, this is a contradiction to say that Elijah is giving this prophecy. Well, no, it isn't. And we'll see that in just a minute. But let me say how interesting this passage is. We mentioned earlier that one of the reasons why we haven't been in Chronicles much for about a year is because we've been dealing with the stories of Elijah and Elisha, and they prophesied almost exclusively to the kings of the north. And the kings in the north are usually dealt with more in the books of 1 and 2 Kings. Now, as it happens, this passage we're about to get into is the only time we have recorded that Elijah had a message for a southern king instead of a northern king. I think that's pretty interesting because remember, Elijah's great call was to go talk to Ahab and his house, prophesy against them. And so he didn't have a charge to go to the south. But now the house of Ahab has worked its hooks into the south, and so Elijah has a prophecy for them too. This is Elijah's last prophecy, and it's his only prophecy to the south. It's the only time Elijah is ever even mentioned in the books of Chronicles, 1st and 2nd Chronicles. It's kind of amazing when you think about how much he comes into the story in 1st Kings and the beginning of 2nd Kings. He's never mentioned in 1st and 2nd Chronicles at all, except for right here. Elisha is not mentioned at all in 1st and 2nd Chronicles. But he has this one prophecy. Now, some have claimed this is a contradiction because the timeline is wrong, and Elijah has to be off the scene. How can Elijah be sending a prophecy to King Jehoram? Elijah departed during the reign of King Jehoshaphat. And we know that because the departure of Elijah is recorded in 2 Kings chapter 2. In 2 Kings chapter 3, we find Elisha giving a prophecy. In that chapter, King Jehoshaphat, king of the south, has made an alliance with King Jehoram. Jehoram of the north, not the Jehoram of the south that we're dealing with here. He's made an alliance with Jehoram of the north to go out and fight a battle, and Elisha ends up going out there to prophesy to them. That's the story we talked about a while back where Elisha had them dig the ditches and God filled them up with water and the Moabites thought it was blood out in the field. So by the Elijah has turned over the office of that prophecy to Elisha while Jehoshaphat's still alive, which means that Elijah is gone. He's already departed. So how is Elijah prophesying now to Jehoshaphat's son if he's not around? Well, the Bible is a wonderful book, and the way this is phrased in verse 12 is very telling. It does not say that Elijah went to prophesy to Jehoram. It doesn't say that Elijah wrote a letter to Jehoram. It just says, and there came a writing to him from Elijah the prophet. Now, the way that's written, it leaves the door open, and I think it was done intentionally this way. It's actually a kind of an awkward way of saying it, to say there came a writing to him in this kind of passive voice way. The reason is that evidently Elijah had written down this prophecy before he departed, and it was kept in hold until now. Remember, we said God works his miracles out sometimes just in his timing. And this prophecy evidently was written down so that it could be there after Elijah was gone to give to this man Jehoram. And it says it came to him. Now, it doesn't say how it came to him. And I don't know how it came to him. Sometimes the Bible is tantalizing. We wish we could know some more details about exactly how this happened. We don't know how this writing came to him. I don't know. Maybe Elijah slipped it into Elisha's pocket before he left and said, there's going to come a time when you have to take this to King Jehoram, and you'll know the time. God will tell you. I don't know. Somehow or other, this comes to him. And it reveals that God had told Elijah about things that would happen in this southern kingdom far after his departure. Here's the prophecy. Verse 12, it says, and there came a writing to him from Elijah the prophet, saying, thus saith the Lord God of David thy father, because thou hast not walked in the ways of Jehoshaphat thy father, nor in the ways of Asa king of Judah, but hast walked in the way of the kings of Israel, and hast made Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem to go a-whoring, like to the whoredoms of the house of Ahab, and also hast slain thy brethren of thy father's house, which were better than thyself. Behold, with a great plague will the Lord smite thy people, and thy children, and thy wives, and all thy goods. And thou shalt have great sickness by disease of thy bowels, until thy bowels fall out, by reason of the sickness day by day. God knew everything that Jehoram was going to do, and he told Elijah to write it down, and he has this writing waiting to be sent down to him at the right time. I wonder why God did it this way instead of having Elisha go make this prophecy. He had a letter from Elijah or a writing from Elijah. I don't know. Maybe the point is that it would have had much more impact, hopefully, on Jehoram, to have a writing in the handwriting of Elijah left down that showed that Elijah saw everything he was going to do even before he came to power. It should have opened his eyes up to see that the God that Elijah served is the one who knows all and sees all and has all power. Unfortunately, it doesn't have that effect on him. It may have been something to protect Elijah because, remember, Elijah had a history that the king in the north, King Ahab, and his wife Jezebel had tried to kill him. And by having this letter come down now after Elijah's gone, he doesn't have to worry about that. He's safe from any assassination attempts. Maybe God just put his prophet in a safe place so that he wouldn't have to deal with that. But what we find here is that God is going to show that he's a jealous God. And he sends this message. This is Elijah's last prophecy, really. And this is going to be the thing that pronounces the condemnation of King Jehoram. Now it says there in verse 16, "Moreover, the Lord stirred up against Jehoram the spirit of the Philistines and of the Arabians that were near the Ethiopians. And they came up into Judah and brake it, and carried away all the substance that was found in the king's house, and his sons also, and his wives, so that there was never a son left him, save Jehoaz, the youngest of his sons." God allows the Philistines and these Arabians here to come make a raid on Jerusalem. This should have been a warning to the nation about their disobedience to the covenant with God. As long as the people of Jerusalem there in Judah were walking in obedience to the covenant and walking in the will of God, you'll find in the scriptures that no enemy could ever mount a successful attack against Jerusalem, no matter how powerful they were, no matter how strong they were. This was the place where God had set his name. In the book of Zechariah, he tells us he's jealous over Zion specifically. And he still is today, by the way, that city, that mountain called Zion over there in Jerusalem. But no enemy could ever overcome this place as long as the people were walking in covenant with God, because God had promised them that would be the case. But now that the people are walking in disobedience, God allows these people to make a raid against Jerusalem. They don't destroy the city, but they capture some of the substance. They carry away all the substance in the king's house and take away his sons and his wives. This should have been a shot across the bow for the nation of Judah. It's a foreshadowing, really, of what would happen long after this, when King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon would come down and raid Jerusalem and eventually destroy the city. They should have taken the warning that if they're disobedient to God, God would remove his hand of protection from them. But they don't. And that's a part of the sad history of this age of the divided kingdom. Well, in the 18th verse, we find how God carries out the prophecy that he'd sent by the hand of Elijah. It says, "After all this, the Lord smote him," that is Jehoram, "in his bowels with an incurable disease. And it came to pass that in process of time, after the end of 2 years, his bowels fell out by reason of his sickness. So he died of sore diseases. And his people made no burning for him like the burning of his fathers. 32 years old was he when he began to reign, and he reigned in Jerusalem 8 years, and departed without being desired. Howbeit they buried him in the city of David, but not in the sepulchres of the kings." God executes his judgment upon this man, and he kills him as he said he would. And at this time, the people of Judah still have enough respect for God that they despise this king who tried to lead them into idolatry. It says they made no burning for him like the burning of his fathers. That would have been an act that they would have carried out to honor a king that had passed away. They would like ceremonial fires, but with him, they don't do that. Remember, they've had 66 years of good rule between Asa and Jehoshaphat. We have generations now who have never known anything but a good king. At this point, the great majority of people who lived in Jerusalem had never known a bad king until Jehoram comes along. They despised him. It says he departed without being desired. Nobody missed him. That'd be a terrible thing to have put on your headstone, wouldn't it? He departed without being desired. Nobody wanted him around. When they buried him in the city of David, that is, in Jerusalem, but they didn't even bury him in the sepulchres of the kings. He was dishonored in his death. I think that's very interesting because you see that after 66 years of having good kings rule, remember Jehoshaphat was the one who sent teachers out into the land to instruct them in the word of God, and most of the people would have still had the memory of this, nearly all of them would have had the memory of this, when Jehoram becomes king, and they did not like what he was doing in their kingdom. Now, the sad thing we're going to see as we get further along in the history of this kingdom of Judah is that they will have other kings who are as wicked or even more wicked than this man. But the people won't be as appalled as they were before, because they're not going to have the influence of the godly kings like they once had. And the standards are going to be dragged down. And the sin's going to be committed, and people aren't going to be sorry for it, and they're going to lose their blush. And I'm afraid that's what's happening in our country today. We have leaders today that are doing things that if they'd been done, even 20 or 30 years ago, 40 years ago, they would have appalled us. And we wouldn't have allowed them to continue to be leaders. But it doesn't seem to bother people today. It's a sad sign for the direction the nation is heading. Well, that's how Jehoram departs from the scene. After he's gone, his son Ahaziah will become king. And we won't go yet into the next chapter and see the story of Ahaziah. We'll be in some in 2 Chronicles and probably some also in 2 Kings next time. Ahaziah comes to the throne now, and he's going to be a very wicked king as well. He's not going to reign a long time. But remember, his mother is this woman from the house of Ahab, and he's going to commit himself to this same kind of wickedness. And remember, what's happening now is we're moving all the pieces in place for the house of Ahab to be judged. And this man Ahaziah, he's kind of a curious character because he is the seed of David, but he also has the blood of Ahab in his veins. That's a terrible thing to think about, isn't it? This is what happens in this nation at this time. They've got this blood of the wicked house now intermingled with the sons of David. Well, we said that God's moving all these pieces into place. He's got Hazael on the throne in Syria. He's getting ready to move Jehu onto the throne of Israel, but the way that's going to happen is going to involve Hazael, king of Syria. See, what's going to happen next, and this is the short version, we'll get more into detail in this as we go on, but we've got this curious situation now where the king of the north is this King Jehoram, and he's the uncle of the king in the south, King Ahaziah. So now there's a close relationship between them, a family relationship. And they're going to end up in a battle with King Hazael of Syria. Now remember the prophecy that God gave Elijah all the way back in 1 Kings 19. About the one that is those who escaped from the sword of Hazael would Jehu slay? Well, they're going to go to battle with Hazael, and they're both going to escape the sword of Jehu, or of Hazael, rather. Jehoram, king of the north, is going to be wounded, but not killed. And he's going to go back to his house in Jezreel that had become a sort of a retreat or a vacation home or an alternate capital or something like that for the kings of the house of Ahab. And it's important, that location's important. We'll come back to that later on too. But so that's the king of the north. He's there in that place at Jezreel, King Jehoram of the north. Because King Ahaziah of the south is so close to him as his nephew, he's going to go visit him there. They're going to be in the same house, the same place at the same time. And unbeknownst to them, a storm is gathering on the horizon because God is going to send this man Jehu out to destroy the house of Ahab and take the throne of Israel in the north. And Ahaziah, king of the south, is going to get caught up in the middle of this just because he happens to be there at the same time. But we'll stop right there for today. We'll continue on with that story next time, Lord willing.